Georg Dortmund und Professor Dr. Ingenieur, Scientific Coordinator, Enterprise Engineering at the Fraunhofer Institute of Software and Systems Engineering at, in Dortmund. He's a senior member of Robinson College at the University of Cambridge in the UK, and he has been scientific director of integrated project financed by EU and primary investigator of various projects with a lot of funding. He holds a Doctor of Philosophy in Computing from Oxford University and is the author of Secure Systems Development in UMS. And the point why we invited particularly him, because he was working in this security for changing software systems, which is the big overarching issue in the CCC. Mm-hmm. We're glad to have you here. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so thanks a lot for the introduction, and thank you very much again for the opportunity to present some results that we've done over the last couple of years in this area. The theme of this symposium is, of course, managing change, and as in the previous talk, I will now specifically focus on the case of security critical systems, and I will present some results that we've been working on for how to manage change for security critical systems. And of course, the challenge here is that software lives longer than intended today and longer than expected. We noticed that, for example, with the year 2000 bug. And of course, the systems evolve. Each part of the system can evolve at any time and does evolve. And the question is, of course, at each such occurrence, whether the security requirements that were previously satisfied by the system are still satisfied after the system changed. And this is something that we've been looking at, this question. And we've been researching that problem in the context of a development approach for security critical software based on model-based development specifically targeted at security critical systems. So just very briefly, as usual, of course, the idea is with model-based development that before you actually started writing the code, you create some models, and we have developed an approach which allows you to include the security requirements in those models. It's an extension of the UML notation called UMLSec. We have developed tools that allow you to verify those models automatically against the security requirements that are included. And of course, there are tools around which allow you to either generate code from the models, or if you still have to manually create the code, at least generate test sequences from the models to make sure that the code also satisfies those security requirements. And, of course, for security, there are also other aspects that are relevant, such as configuration data, including user permissions, and we've also been working on tools which allow you to verify those against the requirements. And in the end, of course, you want to make sure that the running system remains secure, so we've developed another part of our approach which allows you to generate monitors from those models to monitor whether the system actually satisfies the security properties at runtime. And evolution now means that every part of the system, this picture can change at any point, and as I said already, we have to make sure that after those changes, the system still satisfies the security properties. So this raises various questions. For example, whether it's possible to identify preconditions under which we can be sure that the change which just happened preserves the security property that has to be satisfied. If that is the case, then we are lucky insofar that we don't have to re-verify the system, but we know by an abstract argument that the change didn't destroy the security property, so we save the effort that is involved in having to re-verify the system from scratch. And of course, it would be even better if we could decide that before the change was actually implemented, because then if it turns out that the change would violate security, then it might be a good idea not to implement it. And it's also possible to consider various change alternatives with our approach and then choose that alternative which actually preserves the security property in an optimum way. So just a couple of examples to discuss a bit on a more technical level how this works. Just to explain what I mean, that we do model level analysis of security properties. Here we see an example. Firstly, the question, how can we actually verify security properties at a model level using UML models. Here's an example where you can see a UML state chart and of course, firstly, what our tools have to do in order to verify such a behavioral model against a security property is to generate a representation of that model from the given UML diagram, which can then be analyzed using our verification tools. And in this example here, you can see a fragment of the logical formula that is generated from this diagram, namely that part which represents the behavior that is specified by the fact that there is a transition between two states. And this is represented in our in this example by an implication which basically checks that before the transition is executed, the system is in the correct state, the correct message is received, the specified condition is fulfilled, and if all of that has happened, then the specified action is executed and the system goes to the target state of the transition. So that's an example for what we have to do, or basically what the tool has to do in order to generate a representation that can be automatically verified. Then of course the tool also has to generate a representation of the security property that should be verified against the model. Another example for that here is the security property of secure information flow, which basically means that for the confidential data in the system, there should be no indirect information flow to a publicly observable part of the system. For example, if you have a confidential attribute in the system, then there should be no information flow to a public attribute in the system that an attacker can read. And this is informally what secure information flow means. And this property you can then also formalize using a logical formula, which you can see here, which basically means if there are two states of the system that look equivalent to an outside observer, so someone who is not authorized to read the confidential data, and you perform another execution step of the system, then these two separate states should still be look the same to an outside observer. And this basically means that you want to avoid an indirect information flow, which otherwise would happen between the execution of those two states. Again, here we can see a small example, the state chart which we've seen already just now. And this example is supposed to specify a customer account where you have a confidential attribute money, which stores the amount that is currently stored in that account. This is supposed to be a secret. And you have various methods where you can read and write the content of that attribute. In particular, you have a method where you can query whether the system is in a state extra service, which apparently is the case whenever a certain account balance is exceeded. This method is in fact not specified, confidential. So something which, for this simple example, you can maybe immediately see is that you have an insecure information flow from the confidential attribute money to the return value of the public method Rx, because you can see whether the content of that attribute is larger than 1,000 or not. And this is partial information over this confidential attribute, which is leaked out by the return value of this public method Rx. So this is something that should not happen. And a more complicated example, it would not be possible to see that just by looking at it with a bare eye, and therefore it's useful to have an automated verification approach which generates the behavior representation of the model and also the formalization of the security property and is able to verify the model against the property. So this is basically the background work on which on whose basis we have now been investigating what this means in the case of evolution. First, the question is, are there any design or architectural principles that help in the case of evolution, help us to manage the evolution of the system? And there are a couple of such techniques. For example, the design technique of refinement can help us in this situation. Refinement means that you have an abstract specification and you can refine it down to a set of more concrete specifications. This can help in the context of evolution because in that situation you might have an evolution between the different refinements of the abstract specification. And if you were able to prove that the abstract specification satisfies a certain property, such as a security property, and secondly, if your refinement operator preserves that property, then you're basically done. You can perform evolution between the different variants, the different refinements of that system, and you don't have to verify these different variants. And you save a lot of work doing that. That's one technique you can use here. The other technique is that architectural principle of modularization. And of course, this is a very important principle for managing evolution because basically it means that you try to keep the impact of changes in the system localized to a certain part of the system. And if you manage to do that, then again, if the system changes, you only have to re-verify that part of the system against the property, and then basically you're done. You don't have to look at the other parts of the system. And of course, that's also very useful. And this particular principle of modularization you can find in various dimensions. Firstly, in a sort of a vertical way, architectural layers. In many cases, you have, for example, protocols executed on top of each other, which in a sense provide vertical layers of the system. And if you have modularization in that dimension, then this can help. But also in a horizontal sense, component-oriented architectures, or more recently, service-oriented or aspect-oriented architectures. And with respect to these different kinds of principles, we've considered this question under which conditions these kind of motivation strategies actually respect security properties. So to look in a bit more detail regarding those results, firstly regarding refinement. So firstly, the bad news is that for each of those principles, it is actually not obvious or trivial to see whether and under which conditions security properties are indeed preserved under refinement or modularization. So it's not obvious, and it's also not in general actually true. And so we have to invest a little bit of work to see under which conditions this actually works. And firstly, for the case of refinement, that actually, if you look into the literature of formally verifying security properties on a specification level, then it turns out that in fact it is not guaranteed that refinement preserves security properties. In fact, there's some literature which talks about the refinement paradox, which basically means that it can happen that a refinement does not preserve security, although it otherwise is behavior preserving, which seems like a contradiction in a sense, because you would have thought, well, if it preserves behavior, then it should also preserve properties like security. But unfortunately, that's not the case in general. And to see what can go wrong here, let's maybe come back to the example we've looked at earlier. So in this example, you crucially have this transition here, which gives back the return value of that method Rx, which we've already seen was a bad part of the specification. If you now consider a variant of this, that specification where instead of giving back a fixed value true or false, you randomly generate a Boolean value and you return that value, then that variant of the state chart would still have been secure because the return value didn't depend on the actual content of the attribute account. If you generated that random value at runtime. And you can view the state chart, which we've seen already, as a refinement of that that variant of the state chart because it is more concrete, the behavior is more concretely specified. And this is an example where this kind of refinement does not preserve security because, as we've seen already, the state chart we've considered already does not preserve or satisfy the security property. And if you think about this problem in more detail, then it comes out that the reason here is in fact that here we've been mixing two kinds of non-determinism, namely that used for underspecification, which we want to reduce by refinement, and the kind of non-determinism which is actually needed at runtime to provide a security property, in this case the generation of a random value. And if you mix these two kinds of non-determinism and you reduce them by refinement, then of course you may have a problem with security. This seems obvious if you think about it that way, but as you can see in the literature, it's not always been taken into account. So one way to solve this problem that we've been working on is to develop an approach which allows you to concretely distinguish between these two kinds of non-determinism on the specification level. And if you can do that, then of course you can reduce the underspecification without reducing the non-determinism present at runtime, which is needed for security. And on that basis, we were actually able to formally prove that our refinement operator now satisfies, preserves the security properties that we've been considering. Then, secondly, to the issue of modularization. Again, here you firstly run into problems because, in generally, in fact, security properties are not modular without making additional conditions. And again, coming back to the state chart we've already seen. Let's consider the two states in that state chart as state charts in their own right, very simple state charts only consisting of one state each. Then you could argue that each of those two substate charts satisfies the secure information flow property because in each of the two state charts you only have one possible return value, either true or false. So that way you also cannot get back information about the amount stored in the account attribute. But if you put those two states together, the two substate starts together to the state chart we've already seen, then as we know, the security property is not anymore satisfied. So again, an example where in this case, modular composition breaks the security property which was previously satisfied. And this again shows that composition will not always preserve security properties, but you have in fact to make additional assumptions under which security properties are in fact preserved. So, and this is also something we've been looking at. So we have considered some specific situations and considered which conditions you have to establish that in these situations a concrete given security property is in fact preserved under composition. One example result is shown on this slide. In the situation which you can see here, you have a component P1, and this is in this case you have modular decomposition into three subcomponents which are dinned that way. And now the question is if the property, the component P1 satisfies a security property such as secrecy, then can we identify conditions on the components D and U which make sure that the new component P2 actually inherits the security property from the component P1. And we've been looking at some conditions which enforce that this actually works, and the security property is in fact preserved by modular decomposition. Again, based on the formal semantics for the fragment of the UML specification that we're using in our work. And coming back to the example again, this now our approach now shows that in fact it is impossible to compose the two sub-state charts in a way to the state chart which we've already seen in a way that actually satisfies the security property. So we already knew that, but we can now, based on this formal result, we can now actually show that this could never work in this specific instance, because the conditions for securely composing those two sub-models are not satisfied. So this so much about these general principles like refinement and modular composition. A couple of words on some more results we've been working on in the context of security and evolution. This is an approach where we're trying to develop an evolution-based verification. The idea here is, again, after the system changed, we don't want to have to completely re-verify the system. Because, well, although again our approaches that we use for verification are also as far as possible automated, we have had some discussion about that earlier. Nevertheless, even if the verification engines themselves are automated, we still have some manual effort. In some cases, we have to massage the specification so that the verification goes through. We all know that this was discussed earlier, a state explosion problem, etc. So even with an automated verification approach, it's still better if we don't actually have to re-verify the system completely, and we have to deal with the challenge of state explosion. So the idea is now to try to avoid a complete re-verification, but only have to consider the difference between the old and the new version of the model, and just verify those differences again to see whether those differences violate or preserve the security property. And again, we've been working on some results which establish conditions on a, in this case, the level of the formal semantics of the models which investigate whether a certain differences in models preserve the security property or not. We've incorporated that in our tool environment, making use of tools that colleagues have been developing, which can automatically compute the differences between two models, and we exploit that information to perform this kind of re-verification. And actually, it turns out that for in particular for a large size of models, the difference-based verification can be very much more performant compared to the complete re-verification of the model. Again, here a short example coming back to our state chart here on the right-hand side on the slide. Again, let's assume there was a previous version of that state chart where you did not have any return value of that method Rx, and which for that reason was still secure. That state was changed by introducing those return values, which we've already seen. And again, an example where the change destroyed the security property, as we already know, and using this difference-based approach and making use of a heuristic on a technical level on verifying secure information flow, we've seen it was formalized as an implication, which means that there are different combinations of whether the pre and post conditions of the implication are satisfied, and we only have to consider two of them, which in each case buys us some performance at each verification step. And again, here we can see directly that this kind of change now destroys the security property without having to re-verify the complete model. So yeah, so much about the results on the model level. That's at the end of this talk, just a couple of words on how we can now link this to the implementation level. Of course, it's not enough that the models are secure, but the implementation has to be secure as well. And we've been doing quite a bit of work in that direction as well. Firstly, in the case, of course, you need some traceability between the model and the implementation level. And we've worked on an approach which allows you to trace the requirements from the model to the code level. And in the case of evolution, of course, you have to make sure that this traceability is not destroyed by the evolution, but this is in fact preserved as well. And we've been developing an approach based on refactoring in the Eclipse environment, which in fact preserves that traceability. And using that approach, we can now shift the and transport the evolution results we've done on the model level down to the code level, also using work on implementation level verification of security properties. Here's one example, just very briefly, a collaboration with colleagues at Microsoft Research in Cambridge. We have been working on an approach verifying implementations of cryptographic protocols in the C language, and we've done some experiments there, and it turns out that in fact the evolution-based approach helps us here as well to reduce the performance burden which would come with a complete re-verification of the implementation. And alternatively, in those cases where you don't actually have the source code available to verify that, as I mentioned earlier, we've also been working on an approach which allows you to generate monitors to perform runtime verification using those monitors, and also again using the evolution traceability work which I mentioned. We can now also use this runtime verification work in a situation where the software is actually subject under evolution. And again, we've been implementing that, and the experiments show that in this case, the overhead from the monitoring actually is quite reasonable. Okay, so to finish, a couple of works on validation. First, the technical validation, as I mentioned briefly already. Firstly, we've made sure that, of course, these evolution-based verification techniques, we have to make sure that these, in fact, are sound. And this we were able to do on the basis of the formal semantics of our approach. The next question is whether they are actually complete in the sense that we can treat all kinds of evolutions that way. And the answer is, in this case, positive in the sense that you can break down an evolution to a sequence of small set evolutions consisting of deletions, modifications, and addition of model elements. So in principle, it is complete in that sense, although, of course, this is a sort of more theoretical result, because in general, it may mean that if your model changed completely, you have to go back to the basically the empty model, and you build it up again completely by small step changes, which, of course, in the end is not going to be practical. So theoretically, it is complete, but the question is still in which cases it actually buys you something over a normal re-verification. And the result there is that, yes, it makes sense to use this kind of difference-based verification in the situation where the amount of changes are limited with respect to the overall size of the software. Of course, if the software changed completely, so there is no similarity between the old and the new version, then this doesn't buy you anything. But in the case where the amount of changes are limited, we've actually been seeing in our experiments that this can actually give you a significant improvement. And this condition is actually satisfied in practical situations, for example, where you have a software which is essentially stable but still are subject to some maintenance, and in that case it actually pays to use this kind of difference-based verification. For practical verification, we've also been trying out this approach in a couple of joint projects with industrial partners, and again here the results were quite promising. I don't have the time now to go into detail there, but if you're interested in any of those results, of course we'll discuss this in the coffee break. And We've also been looking at some works on how to try to come up with an empirical result on whether how model-based validation actually performs to more traditional quality assurance, such as testing. And again, I don't really have the time to go into detail here, but if you're interested, we can discuss about that in the break. So, yeah, last slide. Just to wrap up, I've been talking, I've been giving an overview on some results that we've been working on with respect to the challenge that on the one hand, software is subject to evolution, on the other hand, it has to still satisfy the security properties after each change. And on the basis of an approach for model-based development and security analysis, we've been developing results and conditions under which, for example, changes do preserve security properties, and we've been developing an approach for different phase verification which allow us a re-verification of the system on the basis of the differences that took place. And that we've been implementing those results in our tool environment and evaluating under which condition is actually provides a benefit, and there were in fact scenarios where this leads to a significant performance improvement. We are currently continuing this work, for example, in the context of a project within the priority program by the German Science Foundation, Design for Future, and so this is work which is very much subject to further investigation. Thanks a lot for your interest, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. So, do we have questions?
So, any security properties are particularly hard to verify in general.
Yes.
So and also the refinement relations which guarantee signatures.
So firstly, yes, so there's a trade-off between, for example, in the case of refinement, there's an obvious trade-off how flexible the refinement is, and on the other hand, how many security properties you can then still preserve. And this is sort of an engineering trade-off, and I don't think there is an optimal solution for that. I think it's best to have different variants. So if you want to change your system very drastically, then you should, of course, still be allowed to do that. And in that case, well, maybe this approach doesn't apply. But in many cases where you only have a limited change, that can apply, and there actually provides you some significant benefit. That's basically your first part of the question. Then the second part, in a sense, this is something that we're doing. So you said, why not rerun the analysis and look into what changes within that analysis. In a sense, this is what we're doing because we are considering the changes on the in the context of the formal representation that our tool creates from the models. And in a sense, this is closely linked to the analysis that has to be performed in order to verify that representation. Although, as far as possible, we would like to come up with conditions that are independent of the actual verification approach that is used. So here I showed formalizations using first-order logic, which we use in the connection of an automated theorem prover for that. But we're also using temporal logic verifications together with model checkers. So we would like, as far as possible, view the verification engine itself as a black box and have the conditions on the higher level of the actual formalization, the logical formalization, as opposed to having to dig into the actual proof script, basically. Because if we manage to do that, we can still have the verification engine interchangeable and be more flexible that way. So that, but Of course, again, there is a trade-off there, and this is also something which I think is also very interesting to actually look inside the verification engine and to try to propagate the differences to down to the proof scripts and try to investigate the situation there. I agree this is also very interesting.
Thank you very much again. Mm-hmm.